Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Sport podcast. I am Ross Tucker. Today, without my usual co-host, Mike Finch, that's because Mike is currently sitting on an aeroplane, which I guess would be somewhere over Europe, because he's on a flight back from Amsterdam. This after spending a week and a half in Budapest covering the World Athletics Champs, as you may know from our coverage last week. So he will be back tonight, and we are planning to record a podcast recap of those World Athletics Championships, in which I will no doubt continue to get jealous at the great experience it seems Mike had over there. I certainly enjoyed World Champs. I thought it was one of the better ones in recent memory, and I hope that you enjoyed our coverage of it, whether it was through live Instagram posts or listening to the podcast that we made available. Those of you who are Patreon members would have heard all those podcasts, plus there was some really good engagement on the Patreon message boards about some of the action we saw from Hungary. We shift gears now that the World Athletics Champs are finished, and we move on to the next major global competition, which is the Rugby World Cup that starts in a week and a half. Now, I'm obviously intimately involved in the rugby world, and so we are planning to do a couple of podcasts on the sport with particular reference to safety, player welfare, concussion, brain injury, the things that unfortunately dominate, some of the coverage of rugby, even when rugby matches happen. And here I think, for instance, of the Owen Farrell controversy recently. So what we plan to do is to explain why changes have been made and how they've been implemented and what the intention is and where some of the challenges have been. So we're looking forward to that discussion in the context of the Rugby World Cup in France. It won't be exclusively about rugby for the next while, though. There is a Vuelta a España on, which is shaping up to be incredibly competitive. So far, it's been full of controversy. Yesterday, we managed to get all the way to the finish line before the controversy hit. And then the stage winner and new race leader, Remco Evenepoel, crashed into someone about 50 yards beyond the finish line and stood up with blood coming down from a cut just near his left eyebrow, and with the potential, obviously, for a significant head impact there. And in fact, Deborah Latouf got in touch on Patreon overnight and said, what do we think of that? Should that be an accident that would necessitate a concussion screen? And of course, they may well have done that. It's possible that once he finished his jersey ceremony and his obligatory media interviews, he went off and had a screen. I fully expect that he will start the race in the red jersey today. But this, I guess, is one of the problems for all sports. Cycling is one of them, where you have these incidents which have clearly got the potential to cause a head injury, and then you're very much reliant on people on the ground to do the necessary tests, to take those seriously enough, and also relying on tools that we know are imperfect. Sometimes players pass those with concussion. Sometimes they fail them without. And so all the sports that involve head impacts, however infrequent or frequent, have got some challenges in this regard. So even cycling, it seems, circles us back to the concussion issue. But it is not all we'll talk about. We'll talk a little bit about the Vuelta action. Some of the physiology is really interesting. We've got, for instance, Jonas Vingegaard, who's going for the Tour Vuelta double, which is very infrequently done because the physiological demand to recover from the Tour de France and then to regain the training status in time for the Vuelta is often too much to ask. And in fact, in that regard, Gareth Davies, who's one of our most prolific members on Patreon, shared with me a very interesting article that was published in Velo News. And it was called How Jonas Vingegaard Trained to Crush Tadej Pogacar at the Tour de France. And they basically interviewed the trainer at Jumbo-Visma, the head of performance, a guy called Mathieu Heyburg. And he talks about the key concepts. And one of them was consistency. Another one was training strengths rather than weaknesses. And it's interesting to compare what Vingegaard would have done in the time between the Tour and the Vuelta compared to his build-up to the Tour, and then to look at the implications that has for performance. So let's allow that race to develop over time, and then we will have a really good discussion, I think, around what we are seeing. We've got, obviously, Evenepoel, Roglic in opposition to Vingegaard, and I think it's shaping up to be one of the best Vueltas, if not best Grand Tours in a long time because of the route and those rivals. Then in addition to that, we've also got, just as a preview, a couple of other podcasts that we've had on deck for a while, and we've sort of put them off because of busy schedules and so on, and we're hoping to get those out. So there's a lot of variety coming, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make. It's not all concussion-focused. However, today is a concussion focus, and it's an interview that I did with an expert in physiology and public health from Tufts University. And the way this came about was somewhat serendipitously. I got a couple of emails from patron members, and here's particular thanks to Paul Whitney and Sam Fairhurst, who both contacted me about 2 weeks ago to ask about a product that they'd seen being worn by certain athletes during football matches, cricket matches, and American football. And it's a product called the Q collar. It basically looks like a horseshoe-shaped collar that goes over the back of the neck. And the idea behind this device is it then squeezes very lightly the jugular veins. And it's been promoted as a way to initially reduce concussion risk and later to reduce the harmful effects of repeated head impacts and brain injuries. And then, coincidentally, I followed on Twitter the person you're about to hear me interview. That is a physiologist and an expert in public health and community medicine. In fact, he's professor of those at Tufts University. And that is Professor James Smoliger. And James has done considerable amounts of work trying to explain and debunk some of the science that underpins this Q collar. And so, given your requests via Patreon and given my new interactions with James, I said, look, why don't we go about doing this? And James was very keen. In fact, he said if I ever feel like exploring it, he'd be more than happy to chat. And I jumped at the chance because I think it is really interesting. And so we dive into that, and that's the interview that you're about to hear. Some of it gets really technical. This is a niche subject, and it involves quite specific academic discussions and debunking of tools, debunking of statistical approaches that are used. But what I really hope comes across is the rigor with which scientists have to try and scrutinize claims that are made by companies like this. And you can apply these same concepts to pretty much any commercial company or commercial product in the health sciences space, and there are many of them. And what James will talk to you about is why you look at it with a critical eye, a cynical eye, what you go about trying to debunk, how you try and disprove or evaluate the claims that are made. And by the end of it, I hope that you'll realize, first of all, on the specific issue of the Q collar, that there is no evidence that it is protective. In fact, there is no biological rationale or premise by which it would be effective. And so the foundation on which it risks, on which it rests, is very much discredited by James and some colleagues' work. But more broadly than that, I hope that it gives you a dose of scientific skepticism that you can then take and apply to other claims that are made in this space as well. So let me not delay any further. Let me introduce to you our guest today, and hopefully a topic that gives you specific and general principles that you can take to become a more discerning thinker when it comes to health products and the claims they make. Here is our guest, Dr. James Smoliger. Welcome, James. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate our serendipitous interaction on Twitter that's led to this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So just by way of context, a guy called Trent Stellingworth, who's known to listeners, tweeted something about the coverage in the Athletics World Championships, and you replied to it, and I replied to it, and through that I said, let me look into this, and I looked at your Twitter page, and subsequently some of your publications, and followed you, and then you got in touch to talk about this, the subject of today's podcast, which is the cue collar. But I was going through your page at the Tufts University of your publications, and I have to say, sports science does throw up some really cool publications sometimes, but I've not seen someone with the range of things in their CV that you've got. I want to read just a few titles of articles you published. Here's one called Premature Death in Bodybuilders. What do you know? Serious subject. Kids on the Run. Is marathon running safe for children? Another serious, relevant one. Maybe we'll tap into you for that one at some stage. Here's one called Giving Science the Finger. Is the second to fourth digit ratio a biomarker of good luck? A cross-sectional study. Pseudo-medicine for sports concussions in the USA. Where's the other one that I thought was so interesting? Woodpeckers don't play football. Implications for a novel brain protection device using mild jugular compression. And that, of course, is the main subject of today's podcast. But let me ask you this by way of background. How does a sports scientist and a physiology professor become a mythbuster and a hunter of pseudoscience the way that you seem to have done?
That's a great question. I'm an oddball. My first degree is actually in veterinary medicine. And you mentioned Trent Stellingworth before. So Trent and I actually overlapped for 1 year at Cornell. He probably doesn't remember that, but I ran with the teams sometimes. And he and I overlapped while I was there. So I'm a veterinarian by background. And then I decided I got a PhD in sports medicine. And over the years, you know, I was interested in a lot of research methodology and statistics. And I think the thing that started it all for me, there was a paper that came out back in, I think it was 2014, that claimed that facial attractiveness was related to Tour de France finish. And so I look at this and I say, why, you know, do more attractive cyclists actually finish better than the Tour de France? I got a bunch of media coverage. And so I got my friend and colleague, Jerry Zaborski, he and I started looking at it. And we just started dissecting this. And this paper was complete nonsense. And I mean, they hadn't even used the term Peloton correctly. I mean, it was all over the place. And so we started writing papers about this whole idea that, look, this is really bad research, and it's giving people the wrong idea about science and about sports performance. And then one of the reviewers of the paper mentioned something about digit ratio. And I said, well, what's digit ratio? And I started looking into it, and you pull the thread and you start finding out that it's the epitome of the reproducibility crisis. And so I started finding that there's a lot of really bad science.
Sorry to interrupt you. Like, Park, hold that thought, because I'd like you to start again at that. On the digit ratio, though, and at the risk of derailing this podcast, it is interesting. Can you just tell us what the digit ratio theory is and what about it you debunked? Well, all of it, but specifically how you went about that?
Right. So the digit ratio theory is that your second to fourth, the ratio of the second to fourth fingers on your hand, your index and your ring finger, are related to how much prenatal testosterone you're exposed to in utero. And that is somehow related to future sports performance, future disease risk, risk-taking behavior, and such. And there's a lot of research about it. In my opinion, it's all complete junk that's basically statistical noise and selective reporting.
There was a book. What was the name of the book and who wrote it on that? I mean, it became a big deal at one point. It was part of it was Jamaican sprint success was digit ratio.
Yeah.
Rugby player success was digit ratio. Who was the guy that did the book?
So John Manning is kind of the father of digit ratio research. I'm not familiar with his book specifically. I'm familiar with his other papers, but yeah.
Yeah, that's the name. Okay, so all right, so that's one in your debit column. What you were then saying that you became interested in the statistical failures of some of the research, and you decided you were going to pursue those, and then I interrupted you. So please do continue there.
Well, basically, what I started finding is, you know, I really like statistics, and it's something I've spent a lot of time learning over the years, and I always wanted to make sure my research was done properly with the most robust statistical methods. And, you know, everybody's human, everybody, you know, makes mistakes, and there's, you know, at different points in one's career, you discover new things. But I started discovering that there were some really shoddy statistical analyses done in different papers. And as I started exploring this, I started realizing that, you know, some of these issues in the research reproducibility crisis, in that there's a lot of problems out there. You know, people's careers are dependent on producing positive findings, or at least they feel their careers are dependent on producing positive findings. And that's what makes for interesting media stories. And there's a lot of incentive to have results which sound interesting. And that's kind of how I got into some of this research, and especially in the sports performance field. I spent so much time learning about sports performance and what the factors are associated with it. And then to start seeing that there's research that claims that, you know, digit ratio, you know, could be used for screening athletes. It just made no sense. And eventually this sort of led me to a broader, you know, kind of myth busting within the field of sports science and exercise physiology, when I started discovering that the problems go beyond statistics, and especially whenever you get commercial interest involved. And I thought, one of the reasons I got into sports medicine, sports science field was to help people, to help them make more informed decisions, to be safer, be better performers. And there's so many nuances and so many things that the public might not be able to understand. It just seemed like getting involved in some of this myth busting seemed to be a valuable part of the job.
Yeah. Do you think that these, they're certainly not unique to the sports sciences. The reproducibility crisis, I know, has impacted many fields of the sciences, but I do get the impression, no doubt because it's the field we're both in, that the sports sciences are quite vulnerable to it because they're media friendly and because there's a professional sport angle and we're all fans at heart. And so the selling point of bad science is a little bit easier sometimes in this field than it would be for some others. Would you agree with that? And I mean, how bad is it in the sports sciences, would you say?
I agree 100%. I think it's really been the sports sciences, and has been so for a while. There's always some kind of new trend or some new fad out there where people want a quick fix, whether that's to improve their performance or to prevent injuries or to treat injuries. It's always there. And the thing is, athletes are very high profile. I mean, you look a few years ago with, you know, first it was kinesio tape. You know, everybody in the Olympics is wearing kinesio tape. Mm. Then Michael Phelps walks out one day and he's got a bunch of suction cup marks on him. Everybody says, well, what's that about? And then before you know it, everybody's into cupping. And you see this all the time. And it's very easy. Athletes are, you know, their faces are everywhere. Their bodies are everywhere. And they also represent, you know, the best in human performance. So if Michael Phelps is cupping, or, you know, some top volleyball athletes are using kinesio tape, we see that. And it's just like all these fitness magazines out there, they're telling you, here's the routine that this one person uses to be their best or to prevent injuries. And therefore people try to apply it to themselves, whether or not there's real evidence or not. And I think there's just so much celebrity endorsement out there. And even if a celebrity is not endorsing it, if somebody sees what they're using, people assume, well, it must work, and hey, it's worth a shot.
Yep, pretty much agree. I think it's a big issue, and it's sometimes well-intentioned. There's no doubt that there are good intentions behind much of it, but then sometimes people will pick up opportunistically and say, here's a product idea, and then they run with it. I suppose there's a broader question, and again, I'm at the risk of derailing, or delaying rather, getting onto the main subject, is a lot of the stuff that gets done, and you mentioned cupping, you mentioned kinesio tape, that power balance bracelet was for me one of the classic examples I can remember.
Right.
A lot of the time, other than the small financial cost and an opportunity cost, they probably don't necessarily cause harm. Or would you reject the notion that athletes should just do it because even if it doesn't really work, if the athlete feels it might, then go for it? Or would you draw a line, would you set a bar below that standard, or above that standard rather?
Right. I think it's kind of a case-by-case type of basis. You know, and it's how we define doing harm. I think something like kinesio tape, just the theories behind proprioception make sense. Whether or not kinesio tape, there's anything magic about it or whatever, that's another issue. You know, so I think in some cases, some interventions are completely innocuous, and there's really no harm whatsoever. In other cases, I think interventions, you know, any of these things to improve performance or improve safety, I think it depends on a case-by-case basis. Some of them might potentially do more harm than good. And I think, especially with some of these protective devices, one of the concerns, and I'll get into this a little bit later, is just this idea of risk compensation. If you feel safer because you feel a sense of protection, maybe you're going to play differently. Maybe you're going to have a placebo effect in terms of signs or symptoms of some issues such as concussion, or maybe other people will behave differently, whether that's other players feel you're more protected, or maybe team medical personnel feel, okay, well, you're wearing this intervention, or you're taking this, so you're probably safer, so we're going to take your complaints less seriously, or we're going to assume you're at less risk. And I think that's where the real danger is. And I think that's kind of a case-by-case basis. It really depends on what the intervention is. The other thing, too, is that in many cases, you know, these elite athletes have nothing to lose. You know, if they're buying something for $200, they might not even be buying it. The team might be supplying it. It's not essentially costing anybody anything. But when you're talking at the individual level about, you know, a high school student spending $200 on some sort of intervention, that maybe they could have invested that $200 in something better that would have improved, you know, that maybe would have improved their safety better or helped their performance or something along those lines. So I think in some cases, some things might have a real indirect or direct harm. Sometimes it's completely inconsequential.
Yeah, I've certainly taken, when speaking to coaches and athletes, of making them understand that there's a trade-off here. There's a cost-benefit analysis you have to do, and sports science can very rarely give you concrete answers on either side of that balance. It's difficult to quantify right. the benefit, but it's also difficult to quantify the cost. Beyond the $200 or the however many hours it takes of time, there's an opportunity cost that's not always easy to see. But if you ever do come across something that's got zero cost and unknown benefit, then you would probably still do it. But the moment there's a cost on one side, you have to know there's a benefit. Otherwise, you're inviting something that may only be detrimental, even if indirectly. And I guess that is you brought up their protective devices, and that is a segue to the main subject. So I can stop delaying us now and get on to the point of this conversation is the cue collar. And perhaps you can introduce it by telling us a little bit about what the cue collar is and how it came to your attention.
Great. So first of all, I want to start off by saying I do not believe the cue collar is effective for protecting the brain, whatever that means. And I don't think all these athletes that are wearing it have any actual benefit from it other than maybe some financial, you know, if they make money by wearing the device, if they're being paid or anything like that. But I don't think there's any benefit. I think there is potential harm. I just want to get that up front.
Yeah,
so the cue collar is a device that is worn around the neck, which is meant to lightly compress the jugular veins. So the jugular veins are the veins that carry blood from the brain back to your heart. And the idea is that by compressing the jugular veins, the cue collar will allow a little bit of extra blood to stay in the brain within the skull. And that will create this cushioning, in theory, around the brain. So this way, when you take a hard hit, brain will kind of have this bubble wrap effect, and it won't be as likely to get injured. And that's the idea, the general idea behind the cue collar. So that's our starting point.
Jim, let me just ask you very quickly sorry, if I can just interrupt there and just say the reason that is positioned by the manufacturer themselves as potentially effective or plausible is because the mechanism of a concussion involves the movement of the brain inside the skull in this sort of fluid space that it's in. And it's funny, I work now in concussion, and I'll be the first to say I haven't gone into the neurology and the detail of it because I don't need to. I'm more interested in the systems that cause concussion, not the specifics. But they introduced this term called slosh. So before we go into the evidence and so forth, or lack thereof, maybe you can just, as a very basic primer, explain how a concussion occurs and why this device was positioned as plausible in the first place.
Right. Those are definitely two different things. I'll talk about the plausibility part second. We'll talk about slosh first. So slosh, it's a very, I would even say, oversimplified concept that the brain is this you know, structure floating around inside the skull, bathed in cerebrospinal fluid, and that essentially when one gets a hit, the brain essentially, as you'll see in some videos, it bounces around and ricochets off the skull. And that's an, I'm not saying that's untrue, it's an oversimplification of tissue biomechanics. Our skull has, you know, one set of tissue biomechanics. Different parts of the brain, the white matter versus the gray matter, have different tissue biomechanics. And so when somebody does take a hit, there is going to be some deformation in all these tissues in a complex manner. And what can happen, you can have as where there's the coup injury, where the idea is that where the site of impact is where the brain is injured. And then there's the counter coup or contra coup injury, where it's actually on the opposite side of the skull from, or the opposite side of the brain from where the impact took place. And this is all related to this concept of slosh, that, you know, there is movement of the brain inside the skull. And so that's the idea behind it. And you see some of these videos of the brain just kind of jiggling around inside the skull. They give an example in the 2015 Will Smith movie Concussion. And that's really an oversimplification of brain biomechanics. In theory, if you could stop the brain from moving around inside the skull, yeah, then maybe it'd prevent some of these brain injuries. But this idea of just kind of keeping it in place more, you know, I would say that's very much an oversimplification of tissue biomechanics. So the second part to your question is, you know, how the plausibility comes into this. And this is a very kind of long story that starts with the inventor of the Q collar, David Smith, who's a neuro, or I believe he's actually an internal medicine physician. Forgive me if I get that wrong. There's a few neurosurgeons involved. I believe he was internal medicine. And so as the story goes, and again, all this is, you know, available on different interviews and such, he emailed another researcher, Greg Meyer, saying that he had studied woodpeckers and came up with a new concept in how to prevent concussions. And that's a very important word, prevent concussions, because the original, what you'll hear the theme is, this was originally designed to prevent concussions. And when we say a concussion, that's, you know, a series of, you know, neurological signs and symptoms from a distinct impact. And we're going to differentiate that from subconcussive injuries, or subconcussive impacts, which cause chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. So Smith claims that he had studied woodpeckers, and he discovered that the reason that woodpeckers did not get concussions or any kind of brain injury is because they have this special muscle called the omohyoid muscle, which all of us have, which he acknowledges all of us have, and that he discovered that the omohyoid muscle in the woodpecker, every time the woodpecker hits its head against the tree, the omohyoid muscle contracts and it compresses the jugular vein and therefore induces this tighter fit in the brain, this bubble wrap for the brain effect. And if you could somehow replicate this woodpecker's brain protective jugular compression mechanism in humans, then guess what? You may actually prevent concussions. And so that's the idea that started this all. The problem with this idea is there's no evidence anywhere aside from Smith's saying that he discovered it, that such a mechanism exists. In fact, there's evidence to the contrary that woodpeckers actually do get brain injuries, and that there's lots of other ways that they protect their brain, but jugular compression is not part of it.
So on what basis was the first claim made then?
That's a great question. The basis for the claim is that he had studied woodpeckers. There's no peer review paper that ever got produced. There was no data. There was nothing. It's just a claim that he studied woodpeckers. In fact, the PI for the Q collar studies, Greg Meyer, he wrote an editorial published in the New York Times in January of 2014. Talking about how animals might hold the key to stopping the concussion crisis. And in his editorial, he says, we have observed woodpeckers use their jugular veins to, compress their jugular veins to create this tighter fit inside the skull. And there's no evidence for it whatsoever. And so basically there's no data out there. The only person or the only group of people claiming that woodpeckers use jugular compression to protect their brains are the people associated with the cue color. Now, what's interesting as a side note is after I started, after I wrote a few papers about this and started posting this on social media, that there's literally over 300 years of research examining woodpeckers, and the idea of using woodpecker biomimicry was first introduced to for brain protection was first introduced by a physician in the 1970s, and nothing's come of it. And just really showing that there's no evidence for this whatsoever. In a 2021 interview, I believe it is, Smith actually states, well, actually, we weren't able to study woodpeckers. We weren't able to get our hands on a woodpecker because in the U.S., woodpeckers are considered endangered species, which is actually also not true. Woodpeckers are federally protected, but they're not an endangered species. But other groups have looked at woodpeckers either through museum specimens or in overseas. There have been some groups that have actually studied live woodpeckers. You can study woodpeckers and you can produce data, but he hasn't.
So you have the, well, not data perhaps, but at least there is a peer-reviewed paper. In fact, there's a couple. One of them was the one I mentioned in introducing you. Woodpeckers don't play football. Implications for novel brain protection devices using mild jugular compression. That was published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. I'll put, as always, all these links in the show notes so people can have a look at that. And in that article, you described a number of different things woodpeckers do. And I know this is a show about the science of sport and football, rugby, and so on. But I'm so interested in this because I vaguely remember reading pieces at the time. I guess it would have been 2014, 15, about how the woodpecker doesn't get concussed. And it's because of this, what is it called? Omohyoid bone, you said. Is that right? And but you've said
the omohyoid muscle.
Muscle, not bone. But you've described a number of them. You worked with an engineer to write this paper. Maybe just as a brief aside, why do woodpeckers not get as much brain injury as you might predict given the head acceleration load they put themselves through?
Well, the answer is we really don't know how much injury they get. The start to the question is, if a woodpecker does get some sort of brain injury like, syndrome in the wilds, would we find these woodpeckers? I mean, a bunch of other birds, cardinals, blue jays and stuff, they die in the wild at some point too. It's not like we see a bunch of them lying around the forest, other things will eat them. And if woodpeckers are getting any type of brain disease or anything, we're probably not going to see that. That said, back in 2018, a group, I believe from Boston University, led by Farah, actually published a study looking at the histochemical changes in woodpecker brains. And they actually compared it to other birds that don't have this repetitive head impact. And they saw phosphorylated tau, which is perivascular around blood vessels, phosphorylated tau, and that's basically a biomarker of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Now, they can't say that this is pathologic. We don't know that they're having neurologic symptoms like people with CTE have, and we can't say, yes, this is exactly the same thing, but it's, we'll say, from my interpretation of it, it's histologically or on a microscopic level, the changes are similar to that of people with CTE. Now, the problem is woodpeckers don't have brains like humans. Woodpeckers have smooth brains. They don't have gyri and sulci like humans do. So they don't even have the same structure that would allow them to get CTE or something like that. And this is one of the problems with animal models. They've got much smaller brains. The anatomy is different. So it's hard to say they don't get a headache or they don't have symptoms. You think about some of these things that we hear about with CTE, with, psychotic behavior and depression and suicide and things like that. Well, some of those things, birds don't necessarily have the, neuroanatomy to be necessary. And again, I don't want to go off on a broad, metaphysical conversation about, woodpecker consciousness, but it is a very different brain structure. That said, they do have, first of all, woodpeckers aren't hitting their heads. They're hitting their beaks, which is very different than direct head impact. And even their beak, the keratin in their beak, the connective tissue in their beak is very specialized to have special biomechanical properties that might will say absorb a little bit of impact. They've got certain muscles in their beak. With each impact, those muscles are contracting and moving their beak in certain ways. Their head has certain types of the bone in their head is a lot spongier, that might absorb some of the impact. And even the size of their brain is a lot different. In a smaller brain, there's going to be the axons are shorter. There's going to be less rotational forces. So there's all these. There's many different mechanisms that have been studied for over 300 years. There's papers from the 1700s on this, all the way through modern times, with engineers doing finite element modeling to look at what happens in a woodpecker skull and like tissue deformation. But their anatomy is fundamentally different than a human. And also to some of their function, in terms of these muscles that they're using to stiffen or, de-stiffen, I'll say, if that's a word, certain parts of their head and their neck with each impact, it's very different than, being blindsided by a 300-pound individual in an unpredictable manner.
Yeah, okay. So the woodpeckers have many adaptations that may offer some protection against what I'm reading here, forces between 1200 and 1400 G's while pecking. This is from a paper you just spoke about that describes these tau accumulations in the brain's woodpeckers. Again, in the show notes. So the woodpecker turns out to maybe not be the most appropriate mascot for the cue collar, but nevertheless, the theory persists that if you can compress the jugular vein, you create what they themselves, and you mentioned this earlier, is a quote unquote tighter fit of the brain in the skull. And this reduces the movement and therefore reduces the concussion risk. So let's shift from woodpeckers to football players, rugby players, whatever, pick your sport, pick your contact sport, boxers. And let's talk a little bit about that. Because when you go to the cue collar website, you will, and I think this is probably a universal characteristic, find a tab at the top called Science. And when you click on that Science tab, you will see cue collar research. And then it lists them and it gives them it'll give you these summaries of what I'm counting here is probably a dozen different studies, both preclinical and clinical. So let's talk a little bit about the evidence that is offered in support of the cue collar concept and where that evidence fails to live up to scrutiny or to survive scientific scrutiny.
So The first piece of evidence that they used to support this concept of the cue collar, again, it comes back to concussion prevention. And I emphasize concussion prevention in distinct, individual hits that cause neurologic signs and symptoms. And in their original world premiere video to demonstrate their partnership with a company called Bauer Sports Performance Group, Sports Performance Group, which had manufactured Bauer hockey equipment or owned it. And that original video, they mentioned the woodpecker, and then they mentioned another series of studies as far as concussion prevention as evidence for this, was this idea that the rate of concussions or the likelihood you'd get a concussion was around 30% lower at higher altitudes. And in those two peer-reviewed papers, they claim that, well, at higher altitudes, maybe there is a little bit of brain swelling that happened, which would induce tighter fit and lower the risk of concussion. And that they found that, concussions were reduced by about 30% at higher altitudes. And this is actually how I first got introduced to the cue collar.
Why does altitude cause brain swelling? This is again part of the plausibility, and I think important, because as we explore this, you and a colleague are going to show that it's not plausible. But let's just pause on that for a moment. Right. You go to altitude and you get this tighter fit. That's a normal, well, it's not normal, it's pathological in some cases and potentially lethal. But just let's talk about what happens to the brain at altitude.
So basically at high altitude, and when I say high altitude, I'm talking, around 15,000 feet in general. And so that's right around like 4,500 meters above sea level. Some people rarely get a pathological condition called high altitude cerebral edema. And there's a lot of different theories on why high altitude cerebral edema happens and why some people are more susceptible than others. But it seems to relate to the hypoxia or lack of oxygen In the air in terms of partial pressure of oxygen in the air. So there's fewer oxygen molecules in the air. The percent of oxygen in the air is still the same, around 21%, but there's fewer oxygen molecules. And if there's less oxygen in the blood, hypoxemia, there's some sort of physiologic changes that happen. Maybe it involves a change in the way some ion channels function. Maybe it involves a change in something like nitric oxide synthase, and there's some change in vasodilation in the brain. But somehow it seems like the blood-brain barrier might be a little bit compromised, and we start getting fluid that winds up through some changes in the brain vasculature, we start getting extra fluid in the brain. And this high altitude cerebral edema, again, usually is occurring at extreme altitudes around 4,500 meters or more. It can occur at lower altitudes, but usually less than that. And it's considered a medical emergency. Mm. I mean, it's something that if left untreated, people will die from. And so that's the idea behind it. And again, there's lots of different theories on the physiological basis, but it really seems to come down to changes in blood oxygen levels or maybe blood carbon dioxide levels. But what really caught me, what introduced me to this whole tighter fit theory and Q-color theory was when this paper got published, a colleague said to me, this is kind of a funny story, a colleague said to me, hey, there's a new paper that links high altitudes to concussion risk. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting. And I said, what altitude? And my colleague said to me, he said, 600 feet. And I said, no, that can't be right. It's got to be at least 6,000 feet or something. 600 feet, 200 meters, or 196 meters more precisely, isn't enough to do anything. He said, no, it's 600 feet. I said, no, it can't be. And he said, here, let me show you.
And yeah, I also couldn't believe this. I opened this link and I saw this and I said, there has to be a mistake. I mean, 600 feet is... we've got a mountain here in Cape Town. I can almost see it from where I'm sitting. And you wouldn't even have climbed a quarter of that and you'd have been at 600 feet above sea level. And so, right. So it's, yeah. It's anyway, the study in question was called Altitude Modulates Concussion Incidence, Implications for Optimizing Brain Compliance to Prevent Brain Injury in Athletes. And it basically looks at high school football, if I remember correctly. And yeah, they define high altitude as above 600 feet. So you look at this and I'm assuming you had the same thoughts as I've had. That's impossible. That's not altitude.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I call my friend and colleague Jerry Zaworski, who's got lots of experience with high altitude research, and I haven't been a high altitude researcher, but I've taught it. I designed our altitude environmental chamber. And, you know, I'm as a physiology person, I'm very familiar with it. So I call him up and I say, hey, look, there's this paper that connects high altitude with concussion risk. His very first question to me was, what's the altitude? And I said, 600 feet. He said, surely you have to be mistaken. I said, trust me, I just had the same conversation with a colleague. It's 600 feet. So anyway, he said, well, this can't be true. And the thing is, too, when you really look at this relationship between changes in the brain and elevation, it's not a linear relationship. It's not like, okay, well, if blood oxygen levels go down, you know, at 15,000 feet, maybe they're half that at 7,000 feet. It's not linear. It's kind of a sigmoidal relationship, just kind of the way some of the physiology works out. So you really wouldn't expect 600 feet to make a difference. And just for completeness, the way that they determined 600 feet was by essentially looking at, they had a bunch of data from high school athletes, a bunch of concussion data, and they took, you know, all these games and practices, and they took the median altitude at which from their data set. And the median altitude was, and they describe it, it would be like having, you know, a group of, you know, whatever you want to say, you know, a group of obese patients, and the median weight was 400 pounds. So you call anybody under 400 pounds the skinny patients, or a group of elite sprinters, and you know, maybe the median 100 meter time is 9.95. So you call, you know, anybody slower than that slow people. It just all kind of arbitrary. You know, 600, anything above 600 feet isn't higher altitude. It was just a convenience point. So anyway, Jerry Zaworski wrote a bunch of letters to the editor explaining why this physiologic explanation made no sense. And I'll also state too, something that's important in these studies, in these original studies talking about the effect of high altitude causing this tighter fit theory, and maybe we could replicate this to prevent concussions. It should be noted that at the time, David Smith, the one that invented the cue collar, he had first applied for a patent in 2009. And these papers were published in 2013, 2014. And Smith's conflict of interest that he actually had a jugular compression device designed to, you know, mimic the effects of high altitude wasn't mentioned in their first paper. It is actually mentioned in the second paper, but, you know, they do talk about jugular compression and, you know, the benefits of this without mentioning that he's got a financial conflict of interest. And then there were a few errors in the paper, like stating that the percent of oxygen in the air goes down at high altitude. I'm surprised it got past peer review. But long story short, Jerry and I later replicated the study using 4 years of NFL data, using the exact same data set, and saw that 1 year was a complete outlier. Altitude seemed to be associated with concussion, and the other 3 years it wasn't. And then we replicated the study again, my colleague Zach Binney and I. We did it for 8 years of NFL data, and there's no relationship between altitude and concussion. In other words, it's a non-reproducible result, or it's just kind of a statistical fluke due to chance. So, and in their original video discussing the cue collar and all the benefits behind it, again, they lean on two things very heavily. One, woodpeckers do it, which we know isn't true. And two, here's good evidence. There's fewer concussions at higher altitude, but we show that's not a reproducible effect. So the very support behind the cue collar preventing concussions doesn't exist.
Yeah, so, I want to go back to the altitude study very quickly, because I think it's important to understand this. What we're saying is that the part of the justification for the cue collar is that it would compress the jugular vein and cause this tighter fit in the brain, and that would be protective against concussions. And evidence in support of that theory was provided by altitude, which allegedly would achieve the same thing, causing this jugular vein, presumably constriction of some kind, that would cause, I think you worded as more blood around the brain. Is that, would that be correct? I mean, that's sort of how they worded it. And similarly, this tighter fit.
Yeah.
That study is largely debunked. And again, I'm going to put this in the show notes. The letter from your colleague, Gerald Zaworski, ends, I have not read as many letters as scathing as this, by the way. It says, in conclusion, the paper by Smith and colleagues is filled with overzealous interpretations, wrong conclusions, and a blatant misrepresentation of the literature, such that true high-altitude physiology is inappropriately extrapolated to low to mild altitude for the convenience of supporting the author's hypothesis. That's a pretty resounding boot that he stuck into this paper.
Yes.
And the fundamental issues are, number one, the altitude that they're testing is not even close to the altitude required to cause these physiological changes. So the link between jugular compression altitude is absolutely implausible based on this. And secondly, it's a statistical anomaly where they find this, what they report is a 30% reduction, but it has such trivial clinical significance, because in reality, it saves, and I remember reading this in the paper, it literally saves about 0.08 incidents per thousand exposure. So it is clinically trivial, likely a statistical anomaly, and biologically absolutely implausible. So that's the altitude bit. The woodpecker part, they don't even necessarily have the physiological or the anatomical adaptation to wrap this muscle around the jugular vein to cause this compression. So on both fronts, their rationale is it's not just shaky, it's almost non-existent. Is that a fair 2-minute summary of the state of their foundation?
Yeah, and just as a fun side note, we Jerry Zaworski actually published a paper because as you mentioned, 100 feet threshold is completely arbitrary. So what we wanted to see is, again, with statistics, could you find a significant finding just through noise in the data? So we took another arbitrary measure to divide up the same data set, completely arbitrary. And we said, okay, let's look at NFL teams that have an animal logo, such as the Miami Dolphins or the Philadelphia Eagles. And let's look at NFL teams that don't have an animal logo, like the Tennessee Titans or the New York Jets. And that roughly divides, the NFL teams into two even categories. And let's see if animal logo is associated with concussion risk. And lo and behold, teams that have an animal logo have about a 30% reduced risk of concussion compared to teams that don't have an animal logo. And our point with that, and we published that paper also, our point with that was if you take a large enough data set and have a completely arbitrary division in it, you might find some sort of evidence of reduced risk. But if you don't have a solid hypothesis and a solid rationale for looking at that, there's no real meaning to whatever you find. It's not clinically meaningful. And that's what we felt, that 600 foot threshold for the their altitude paper. We felt that was the same thing. It's pure statistical noise and you're finding significance. And most importantly, it's not reproducible. And one other thing I'll put in, when Zach Binney and I, the 8 years of data, we actually won the Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapies yearly award for excellence in research because of that paper debunking the original NFL study, which to the credit of the journal is really nice because we debunked a study published in their own journal years earlier, and we got their one and only annual award for excellence in research for that work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So now, despite the fact that the two pillars upon which this product exists are crumbling, there are a number of studies in humans at the moment. They talk about studies, the human formant study, the hockey study 2014, the football study, I'm reading it off their website, the soccer study. One of the studies they call is the football pivotal trial of 2018 that resulted in FDA approval. How I don't know how it works actually with FDA approval, to be honest with you, in the US. Presumably you've got to jump through some hoops. I don't know if they're particularly high or difficult to get through, but the existence of these studies would be persuasive to many who just look at the website.
Exactly. And that's kind of where I feel some of my value is. Because it does come across as, wow, this is completely valid. And this is what I feel those behind QCAR have done really well. They've set themselves up to have what appears to be good science on their side. And the problem is with so many things, and this is not unique to QCAR, with many things in pharma and science and everything, you hear about the reproducibility crisis, and you hear about something that gets approved, and then, you know, years after approval, we realize that it doesn't work as originally planned, or there's a bunch of side effects. You know, the scientific process, it's all run by humans, and it's all, you know, there's flaws to it. That doesn't mean we should throw out science, but we don't understand the nuance of science. And I think what's happened, my particular opinion in this case is there has been some really shaky science behind all the clinical trials related to this. And so the FDA authorization one is a great example of some of the very shaky science where, again, I think you need to be, you know, a fairly high level scientist who has the time and in looking at these studies and basically finding where the flaws are. Because if you're not a scientist, if you're not, I'll say PhD trained, not to sound elitist or anything, but if you're not PhD trained to read the scientific literature and to relate one scientific paper to another and look back at the clinical trials protocols, you're going to miss these gigantic red flags in these studies. And I think that's one of the things that most of the public isn't aware of.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, this football pivotal trial, there were 142 players in the intervention arm and 142 in the control arm. And then they follow them over the competitive football season. And effectively, they do a pre-post comparison using magnetic resonance imaging data. And I'm just reading off the website now, so I'm putting it in their words. And then I'd like your response to it. Results revealed that 77% of the collar-wearing athletes did not have significant changes to the white matter of their brain, while 73% of the non-collar-wearing athletes had significant changes. So effectively what they're saying is that 3 out of 4 athletes wearing the collar looked the same pre-post, whereas 3 out of 4 athletes not wearing the collar looked different pre-post. Now, that one sentence, I'm a parent of a kid who's playing contact sports and I'm nervous about what I'm reading in the media, and I'm saying I want my child to be in the 77% who don't have significant changes to white matter. And then I say, but what do those significant changes to the white matter actually mean? And the parent says, I don't particularly care, but I'm happy for there to be none. So what is a sign? How do you even broach that conversation now? And why does it matter, I suppose, is the point.
Right. So basically, and I think this is an important point. Who's using the Q-collar? People that are concerned about brain injury. And that includes the athletes. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, most of these athletes, like, they're just trying to protect themselves. They're just trying to do what they feel the right thing is. And that's what these parents and all the other athletes are doing. And so by reading these things, they might actually feel, well, you know what? This might be just what I need to actually feel protected and make me feel safe. And maybe it's the decision that'll, you know, maybe the sense of protection is what makes the difference between participating in football or rugby or some kind of other high risk sport and not, because you see something like this and believe, wow, this is really protecting the brain. So when we really get into it, what they're doing, as you mentioned, is they're doing MRI research, and they're using a specific type of MRI called DTI. It's a special advanced research technique. And it's important to note that this is a research technique. It's not a clinical technique. And so, you know, you're not going to, you know, have some kind of brain issue, go to your doctor, and they're going to order a DTI scan and diagnose you. It's really a research-based technique. And there's some really interesting literature about it, even in the legal field. Should DTI imaging be allowed, admissible as evidence in the courtroom? Because it's highly complex, and it's easy to intentionally or unintentionally misrepresent brain injury with it. And so the idea of DTI is essentially you're theoretically looking at the structural integrity of the white matter within the brain. And so what they're reporting in these studies is, well, the white matter is protected. They look at the, you know, these different DTI values, and it looks like, well, they're unchanged. That must mean the white matter is preserved, and the group that doesn't, you know, that doesn't have the collar on, their white matter is changing. This sounds like it's, well, this is evidence. But as they always say, the devil is very much in the details here. So one of the things with DTI is DTI is a technique. And there's all types of different measurements that you get out of. There's all types of different results that you get out of looking at DTI for any given region of the brain. So there's things like axial diffusivity and fractional anisotropy and mean diffusivity. And there's all these different parameters that you get in a scan. So you put the brain under scan for each region, you might get 4 different numbers. That's for every region of the brain. So just for simplicity's sake, let's say you scan 25 different regions of the brain, and each region has 4 numbers. That's 100 numbers. And so what they're doing, they're getting a lot of data, tons of data. And when you actually start to look at all the different papers together, it seems like at first it looks like, oh, they're consistently finding, you know, this protective mechanism that, you know, the people in the Q-collar group, their numbers aren't changing. People in the non-collar group, their numbers are changing, and that must be bad. But when you're looking at that many different regions, you have to see, are you looking at the same region consistently? And so what we see in some of the studies, if you look at all the studies together, you might see in one study, they say that, you know, in region A, we see a protective effect. That's good. But they don't mention anything about region B. In a different study, they might mention region B of the brain shows protection, but they don't mention anything about region A. And so when you're looking at so many of these different regions and so many different numbers, just by statistical chance alone, you're bound to get some sort of significance. And in their clinical trial protocols, they're not reporting and saying specifically, we're looking at these specific 25 regions of the brain, here's the specific numbers that we're looking for. They're just kind of doing it more general. They're saying, we're going to look at these, we're going to look in a few of these regions, including but not limited to this. And you know, in one study, they might find this parameter changes. In a different study, they'll find a different parameter changes. So that's part of the issue. And it sounds all fancy, and you see all these journals with showing pictures of the brain. Mm. But in reality, the results, it's not consistent between studies seeing this effect. So yeah, that's our starting point.
I think on that, I mean, we've had a few studies been published in the last while in rugby players, retired rugby players, and some even active rugby players that describe the same thing, you know, changes in the white matter, axonal changes. And we often say the same thing. We say, well, what does it actually mean? So what? And the common retort to that is, it doesn't matter what it means. The point is it's different, and you would rather not see a difference than a difference. And it's very difficult to reject that without sounding like you're simply being overly defensive from the perspective of, say, World Rugby, who are defending the sport against various accusations and even lawsuits. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that, as you've explained now how it's basically this scattergun approach. You're just firing away and you're going to hit something. There'll be a target. Right. If you fire enough bullets, you're going to hit a target. People say, well, no, you're just tap dancing now. You're just making semantics to try and hide the reality that head impact exposure changes something and this device protects it. So what do you say then in response to that? Why does it matter?
Well, once again, the devil's in the details. So it's based on the assumption that keeping the DTI number the same is beneficial, and that's a gigantic assumption. Mm. So one of the things, there's a lot of studies that have used DTI for research out there, and one of the things that we know is that DTI numbers change during brain growth and development. And we know now that, growth, that the brain continues to be changing into our mid-20s, maybe even late 20s or so. Our brain is still, I'll say, essentially growing and changing. And if you look at longitudinal studies of adolescents, now we're going to take contact sports and football and stuff out of the picture, just adolescents, their DTI, an adolescent's DTI numbers will change from 1 year to the next. And there's studies to look at the effects of playing sports. There's, you know, like gymnastics, there's studies that look at the effect of playing music and how DTI changes throughout the brain. So one could say that during adolescence, such as in high school football players and even college football players, we would expect there to be some level of change in the brain. That's what normal is. Some DTI numbers should be going up. Some DTI numbers should be going down. That's what normal is. And so to say that, oh, the numbers stay unchanged in the group wearing the collar, you could realistically interpret that as, well, that's abnormal. The numbers, these DTI values should be changing in this adolescent group of athletes. Mm. So that's one important factor. Another thing is the math behind this. And I always like to go with an example of, let's say you had some kind of new supplement and you said it made people stronger or, you know, gave them better muscular endurance. And, you know, at baseline, everybody could do 20 push-ups, and half the people took the supplement, half the people didn't take the supplement. Let's say in the supplement group, let's say they improved to 25 push-ups, but maybe not all those people, maybe on average they improved from 20 to 25, but maybe some of those people went from 20 to 30, and some of those people went down from like 20 to 5. Some people got better, some people got worse. That's what we're actually seeing in some of these studies. In the few studies where they reported their original data, in one of their original studies, they reported DTI data on 21 individuals that wore the Q collar, and around half of them had an increase in their DTI, around half of them had a decrease in their DTI, and two of them stayed the same. So they're claiming, oh, no change. But in reality, no change is just a mathematical mean. Mm. At the individual level, people are changing, but just on average, there's no change. And so that's an important point that I think gets missed in a lot of this. If the average stays the same, that doesn't necessarily mean that at the individual level, people's brains are unchanged. Some numbers might be going up, some might be going down. The other thing to reflect upon too is, again, DTI is a research experimental technique. And one of the things that's been done, there's been a lot of this done in brain injury models in animals. And one of the things that you might see is that, you know, again, I'm going to use graphic terms here. You know, you whack a rat or you whack a mouse on its head and, you know, give it a traumatic brain injury. And then you look at the DTI data. In a lot of those animals, about a month after you've given it this whack on the head and given it a brain injury, the DTI data is back to normal. It's the same as baseline. It's as if they never had a brain injury. But if you dissect the animal's brain, guess what? You see brain injury. And so that's why DTI isn't a clinically validated measure. And again, the FDA notes this in its authorization of the QCALR, that the technique that they use to show effectiveness isn't clinically validated. And that's what we see in animal studies. Just because your DTI hasn't changed, that doesn't mean that there's not some sort of actual anatomical change at the microscopic level, which could be related to function too. So again, the DTI looks really fancy, but does it really indicate that people's brains are healthier? I think we've got a good argument that that's not that, you know, you can't really support that either way. And what's really interesting in, you know, the QCAR website, they tout it as the, you know, only, you know, the only proven method to protect the brain. And they say it's, you know, it's proven for brain protection. In the 2021 New York Times piece on about the QCALR, the PI for the study, Greg Meyer, says, well, we don't really know what the numbers mean, you know, but it's worthy of more research. And that's a very different message when the PI behind the study is quoted as saying, we don't really know how to interpret the numbers, but, you know, we should do more research. That's a very different message than, oh yeah, it's proven to protect the brain.
Something that jumps out to me is if I have a device that is sold as a concussion prevention device, then given that the trials go back to in humans, there's a soccer study, the football study 2015, there's a hockey study 2014. So we've had 9 years. Okay, let's take two off for COVID. 7 years worth of competitive sport, during which time I would have been expecting to see one of these studies report concussion rates in a randomized control trial with and without wearing the QCALR. And instead I'm seeing studies using what you've, I think, described is a very exploratory research method, DTI, whose meaning we don't really know, but in none of these studies do they describe the actual outcome of interest, concussion. Is that because that they are not different and they're just presenting to you a side of the coin they'd rather you saw, or are they still waiting on that? Do you know?
Well, I can give you the answer to that question. In 2021, after the FDA authorized the QCALR, and again, the FDA authorization was given in February of 2021, I believe. And as you noted, there is one instrumental study in that, which I could talk about, and that study has its own issues. So the FDA authorized it in 2021, and then in the fall of 2021, a paper finally came out stating that there was no difference in concussion risk between athletes that wore the QCALR versus athletes that didn't. And this is a really important point. As mentioned earlier, you know, there's in an interview, the PI behind the QCALR, Greg Meyer, talks about David Smith contacting him with a woodpecker-inspired way to prevent concussions. Their original world premiere video in 2015, which, you know, had some big name people, including, you know, hockey star Mark Messier in it. They mentioned the word concussion over 40 times. Their original clinical trials registries, if you go to clinicaltrials.gov and look at the registries, a few of those studies described the QCALR as an anti-concussion device. And there, in one of those original studies, actually said that the primary outcome of interest was concussion incidents or the rate of concussion. And their original goal was to compare the risk of concussion in individuals wearing the QCALR and versus the risk of concussion in individuals not wearing a QCALR. And I believe that was from like 2013 or so, 2014. And it wasn't until 7 years later and lots of other papers later where it finally comes out after FDA authorization that actually this doesn't work to prevent concussions. So Jerry Zaborski and I have been saying all along that there's no way that this should work. It shouldn't prevent concussions. And you know, they marched on with concussion prevention. And then the first NFL player to start wearing the collar was Luke Kuechly for the Carolina Panthers. And I remember when he started wearing it. There were all these news media stories about his new woodpecker-inspired collar, which would prevent concussions and helpfully save his brain. And so I remember my students and I were talking about it. And a few weeks later, 3 weeks after he started wearing the collar, I remember my students came to class one day and said, did you see? And I said, did I see what? Luke Kuechly got a collar got a concussion while wearing the Q collar. And I said, he did? And so live on TV, you know, complete with the collar on him, he gets a concussion while wearing it. And there's some controversy about that too, but I mean, he missed a game after that and everything. He was in the concussion protocol for a while. And, you know, he clearly got a concussion while wearing it. I believe the second player to get to start wearing the Q collar in the NFL, Vernon Davis, there were one or two stories about him wearing the Q collar to prevent concussions. Well, guess what? He got a concussion while wearing it twice. So from the lens I was looking at, what I think was happening was they originally intended this to prevent concussions. Even in their world premiere presentation, they had a neurosurgeon, Dr. Jha, that was on stage, and he said, you know, I think you need to do a clinical trial and have people wear this collar and people not wear this collar. And if you see that the people that, you know, don't wear the collar are more likely to get a concussion, then you've got a home run. And so I think they actually attempted to do that. They attempted to get this on Sports Stars. I personally think it all fell apart and it didn't work as planned. Athletes got concussions while wearing it live on TV. And so then they started changing, in my opinion, their marketing to brain protection.
To be fair though, when we say prevent concussion, they weren't positioning it as 2-0. No one would make that claim, right. Surely. And so the idea that Kuechly would get a concussion on television would have been bad luck and not a great look for them. But I suppose they'd say, well, we never said it would stop concussion entirely. What we said is that if the normal risk of a concussion, and I know in American football they express it per 1,000 athlete exposures. We do it per 1,000 hours. So if the normal concussion incidence was, let's say, 17 per 1,000 hours, we're aiming to get it to 13 per 1,000 hours, which across 500 professional rugby players around the world would be a significant overall effect. So they'll argue that. But it's still interesting that no study has yet come out with that, although you've actually said that there was a 2021 paper, which I'm guessing they're not listing on their research page, right? Because the only 2021 paper here is a jugular vein compression study that doesn't describe concussion as an outcome. So they're burying the negative finding. Unless I'm...
Yeah, and until after the FDA authorization too. I found the timing on that very interesting. And it's actually only... It's Yuan 2021, High School Sports-Related Concussion and the Effect of Jugular Compression Collar, a Prospective Longitudinal Investigation of Neuroimaging and Neurofunctional Outcomes. And even though this was their primary research outcome in one of their first projects, it's basically one paragraph buried in this paper that the concussion group was, or the collar group was, not statistically different in terms of concussion risk than the non-collar group.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting how they then move to something that, so now the product does what they can measure. So they've changed the value offering to what can be measured, which I think is a necessary, but I suppose inevitable shift. What would the study be that would persuade you? What do you think they should do?
So I think basically to persuade me, you would need a completely independent, in other words, not industry funded study, because all their studies have been funded by Q30 Innovations through the same principal investigator, Greg Myers. As far as I know, he's been the PI in all the studies. I know at one point there was over $3 million of research funding given to him. I've lost track since then. And again, I'm not throwing Dr. Meyer under the bus in any way or implying anything, any wrongdoing per se. I'm just saying there's only been one investigator and all of those studies have been funded by Q30 Innovations. I think you would need a large trial, you know, a few hundred people that was prospectively registered, not funded by the company, a different PI, publicly available publicly available data set with all the data from all different regions of the brain, all the different DTI metrics and a good statistician that's controlling for multiple comparisons. And some other things like accelerometry data to quantify impact exposure, well-trained medical staff, whether it's athletic trainers or sideline physicians or whoever, to be diagnosing concussions and to basically look at concussion risk and also some of these brain imaging things. One of the things that we also see in these studies is they're getting a lot of data. They're not just getting DTI data, they're getting their prospectively registered clinical trials are mentioning lots and lots of data, all types of other different tests besides DTI, and they're not reporting all those different data points. For instance, one paper about athletes that had a concussion, the one I mentioned by Yuan, 2021, the clinical trials registry indicates that they looked at post-concussion symptom inventory. It's a survey. They looked at that. The clinical trial mentions that, but in Yuan's paper, that data point isn't mentioned anywhere, even though these are athletes that got a concussion. In another paper that has the same registry, it's the same sample that doesn't look at athletes specifically that had a concussion. They look at the whole group. They do mention the post-concussion symptom inventory data. So again, there's sometimes they're reporting one result that they, you know, something that they tested. Sometimes they're not reporting on it. So I would want a good study that says, here's everything we're going to report on, and reports on all of it, that there's nothing missing from the peer review publications. Other thing that I think is important is good peer reviewers. So in that instrumental study that they cite that was important for the FDA authorization, their original registered protocol said they were going to attempt to recruit up to 500 athletes for it. And one of the things that they mentioned is 40 non-impact control group individuals. And they specifically say cross-country runners in there so they can tweeze out the effects of exercise versus impact. That's actually not that control group of 40 runners, not report anywhere in their studies. So again, you know, some good peer review that could say, wait a minute, the protocol doesn't match the trial. The other issue with your FDA, the study that got them FDA authorization, there's only one peer reviewer on that study, which is pretty unusual in the world of peer review research to only have one peer reviewer on a study. And that's publicly available information. You could look at the study and it says who the editor was for that study of the journal and who the peer reviewer was. And I won't mention the peer reviewer's name. You could find it online though, but that peer reviewer has actually spoken out and said that he had some major concerns with the study. They did a bunch of revisions and he was really concerned that the study that the comment that the way that they would use the study for commercialization would be inappropriate and inconsistent with what the study actually was. So again, you know, I would definitely want to be convinced. I'd want a study with multiple independent peer reviewers, and I'd want to make sure that everything in that study was presented at face value and not extrapolated somehow, if that makes sense.
Would you imagine that they've tried to approach the governing regulatory bodies? And here I'm talking about the NFL, NCAA, and I don't know the structure of sport. I don't know whether you have to go through the Pac-10 or whether you'd have to go through SEC or what organization. But it's interesting to me that these sports are under such pressure because of the concussion issues, and not just concussion, it's also those non-concussive repeated head impacts, that they would be quite open to the idea of supporting a trial that offers this reduction. Yet that doesn't seem to have happened. Do you know whether they've tried that and whether it's been rejected for these same reasons, or is that unknown?
I'm not aware if that's been attempted. And I think one of the concerns is surrounding that is this. It would take a lot of resources. It would take a lot of money. And I would actually even have trouble because everything we talked about earlier, I think the entire basis for this is, I mean, the whole Woodpecker story based on everything I've uncovered is fictitious. And that's the whole reason behind the collar. And to invest a lot of money in independent research for something that probably doesn't make sense, I would rather see that money invested elsewhere. I would rather see if somebody has something that actually has a good scientifically sound basis, I'd rather see people put money into that. Mm. And that's one of the issues with the cholera. When we go back to the earlier part of the conversation, is there potential harm from this? There was just a news story about a high school in Wisconsin, the United States, that bought 110 Q collars for their athletes, you know, at retail value, that's $22,000. I wonder if that $22,000 could have been better spent elsewhere. And likewise, you know, Big East, Pac-10, ACC, if they had $1 million or $2 million to spend on this study, maybe could they spend $1 million or $2 million to do something else to make athletes safer, whether that's hiring more staff, doing better education, doing some kind of other study about education. And that's where my problem is. I think, to answer your earlier question, if I saw a really good independent study that did all these things, that could convince me more if it found an effect. But I'm not sure such a study is actually merited because the scientific basis for this is so weak.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, we have the same dilemma in World Rugby. We invite research from around the world, and we get a lot of proposals from people who obviously have some commercial slant. It's not always apparent what it is, but it's clearly there. And they need access to players in order to confirm their theory. But they can't confirm their theory without access to players. So I actually have some sympathy. We had a case of a protective headgear. You know, in rugby, they play with a soft shell helmet. It's not like in American football.
Right.
And the company was desperate to have this thing rolled out in a clinical trial. And we said, well, we don't support that kind of work. And it ends up being a little bit of a stalemate for them. Because you're right, it's almost like the barriers to entry, research-wise, are so high, but they can't be overcome until there's research. But until there's research, no one wants to take down those barriers. So it really is quite a dilemma for these companies to overcome.
Right.
So whilst I'm not condoning the way they do it, instead, I do have some sympathy with them for it. It must be difficult to because it's a proper catch-22 that they're in.
Yeah.
Mm, mm. You spoke about the cost to a company or to the NCAA, NFL, etc. Let's shrink that right down and sort of end this off and talk about the cost to a parent or a player or a coach or a sports director, medical doctor who wants to try and support a young athlete who's concerned about concussion. And they've heard this, they say, okay, the cue collar probably not what they want to use. But I don't know what it retails for. Is it $200?
$200, yeah.
Is there any justification for saying, look, if you can afford $200, this thing probably doesn't work. Might just be a waste of $200, but hey, why not?
You know, my philosophy on that is, you know, I hate to see people waste their money, and I feel like if that's the philosophy people take, you know, if I really want to go to the dark side, I should start selling my own, you know, concussion prevention for $125 and come up with some kind of, you know, animal inspired idea and just say, look, you know, isn't your child's brain worth $150? You know, and I guess that's the dangerous route to go down, but my bigger concern really is that it is masking the potential dangers. One of the things I mentioned before, this idea of risk compensation, that if you feel protected or you feel others are protected, your behaviors might change. And I know in one of the interviews that, you know, we had for an article, you know, I believe it was Greg Meyer mentioned, well, if that's the case, you know, we probably shouldn't wear seatbelts because, you know, seatbelts, they might make us drive a little bit more dangerously. We take greater risks. And my argument to that is I think there's good evidence that seatbelts work. And I would say there's not good evidence that the cue collar is effective. And so if you look at some of the testimonials on their website, there's one I came across recently. It was about, I believe it was a soccer player. And he said, you know, by wearing the cue collar now, he's got, you know, greater confidence. Sometimes he'll take a really hard hit to the face or he'll hit his head on the ground really hard. And now with the cue collar, he knows, like, he just has to take a minute or two to rest and regain his composure, and then he can get back to playing. I would think that most athletic trainers and medical personnel that are on the sidelines would say, if you take a really hard hit and you need 1 to 2 minutes to regain your composure, you should probably be being evaluated for a concussion in that case. And I think that's the big danger. And again, he's saying now he's got the cue collar. Now that's all he has to do. He knows he could be safe and just take those 1 or 2 minutes. And maybe in the past, he wouldn't have felt as protected. And I think that's where one of the risks is. With anything, there could be a big placebo effect. And, you know, people are describing not getting headaches after wearing it and everything. And maybe that's real, maybe that's placebo. We don't know. But I think the idea is that, again, from some of these comments that we're seeing on the website, people feel protected. I would argue that the protection isn't real and it's placebo effect. And then for anybody that doubts, oh, it couldn't possibly be placebo, if you look into some of the research on placebo and nocebo, it can be a very, very powerful effect. And so, and sometimes we know with concussions that it might take a day, might even take 2 days before people really start to feel the symptoms of a concussion. And if people are having a placebo effect from this and are feeling protected, they might be less likely to actually report that they're having a concussion and might be placing themselves in greater danger of getting more head impacts while having you know, some level of brain damage. I think that's where I'd say there is a danger. And then, like I say, as far as participation goes, if it is that parent that is concerned enough to say, look, it's only $200, I want to feel protected, that's the type of parent that really is concerned about their child's health. And my concern is that if they're trusting something like that to make decisions on participation or not, if they're comfortable with it, if this doesn't work, the only way people are going to know it doesn't work if it's too late, essentially. And that's my biggest concern. Like, it's just, you know, if it doesn't protect from subconcussive impacts, you know, maybe we'll find out, you know, CT really, you know, is, you know, going to be manifesting itself later in life, generally not in its 20s, although there's cases of that. But 5, 10, 20, 25 years down the road, we'll find out it didn't work. And, you know, all the decisions that have been made in that process, maybe, okay, they're allowed to play high school football. All right, let's go on to college football. Let's try out for the NFL. You know, it could be a decision that leads to years and years of extra contact that maybe they wouldn't have done if they didn't feel as protected. And again, I'm not anti-football or anti-contact sports. I just want people to make an informed decision. And right now, I think the side of the story they're hearing is all the marketing side and the athlete testimonials, and they're not hearing all this nuance behind the science.
Yeah, and I suppose, in effect, what's happening is that they're buying an illusion and then behaving as though it's real. So it's the emperor's clothes, in effect. Look at me. And I guess I think you've explained it. It's a side of it that I didn't really consider, this idea that once you've made this investment, even if it's small, you're still making a conceptual investment that might be worth more than $200. The concept being that I'm now protected against the consequences of head impacts. Having made an investment, someone will be less likely to admit that their investment was wrong. And so now you throw up a barrier to what we know is the most effective way to identify a concussion, and that's the athlete telling us that they don't feel right. So that does create threats. If I was a medical practitioner or a parent, I would not want to create any barriers to open disclosure of the consequences. So, yeah, I think these are why, you know, it almost brings us full circle. It's you can, some people might dismiss a lot of the discussion as, you know, the details and the technicals. I mean, what's the harm? You know, what could go wrong? Well, the truth is, not much might go right. And if there's even the risk that something goes wrong indirectly, then actually you're worse off than if you didn't make this investment. And that's very important for people to think about. Good stuff, James. Thanks very much for this. Really have appreciated your time. I can see a few conversations about digit ratios and death and bodybuilders and some of the other funky things you've done in the past, but I think this has been a very good exploration. So thanks very much for your time, and hopefully we'll speak to you soon.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And that is that from James. Unfortunately, what happened last night was I did this recording with him on Zoom, and when I listened back to it, I discovered that the last 2 minutes or so of James's sound were affected by some tech glitch that created this reverberation. You might, in fact, have heard it in his last words there as he sort of said thank you at the end. And it made his last few minutes unusable, which is a real shame, because the question that I asked him to close off the podcast was what I think quite an important one. And it's important because what you've just listened to, of course, is James going into some quite specific and technical detail about this particular product. You know, especially that bit about the DTI, the tool that's used to evaluate changes in the brain over the course of a season. That stuff's really technical. And if you don't come to this with a lot of time on your hands, and in fact, some fairly significant specific knowledge about the tool, it would be very difficult to critique the studies that get published. And so that's why James, in effect, is doing a service. But there's a real risk here that you listen to this and you feel disheartened. You say, my goodness, how am I, mother of two or a father of a 15, 16-year-old aspirant rugby player, meant to critique the claims made when it requires such specific knowledge? And so what I asked James was whether he could offer any advice to people who lack the time and who lack that specific scientific knowledge as to how they might be more discerning and critique claims that are made. And his answers were important enough that I wanted to just share them. So I'm going to paraphrase what he said. And the first point is that when you encounter claims that are significant, simple, and revolutionary, you should always bring a healthy dose of doubt. It's that old saying or adage that if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And so bringing a degree of skepticism is important. If you bring, and this is me now saying, not James, but if you bring hope, then you are going to be deceived. And that's the challenge for parents, because they are hopeful that a device like this can work. And so they come to it wanting to believe. And you have to, and it sounds lousy, and I hate to say it, but you have to take the opposite view. You have to come to it ready to dismiss it as too good to be true, and then be willing to be persuaded otherwise, as opposed to the opposite, where you come hopeful and set yourself up to be effectively manipulated and persuaded that your hope is correct. And that's the first point. And so it helps to be cynical. Let's say skeptical, less extreme than cynical, but that's really important. And then the other thing James said that I think is really important is that when you look into these kinds of claims, be very aware of who is making them. And if they are being made by people who are affiliated and therefore conflicted, and you cannot find the voice of independent experts that supports those opinions, then you need to double up on that skepticism. So it's very easy, for instance, in this product's case, to go to a website and read testimonials by athletes and by researchers. But they are invested in that message. And what James then suggests is that you must look for independent voices, people on the outside who have nothing to gain from their opinion or potentially endorsement or positive confirmation of certain claims. They are the voices that you'd be more interested in. Now, it's not always easy to know who's truly independent and who's not, but it's usually relatively easy to know who is conflicted. And again, if there are no independent voices, then that should be a warning sign that nobody outside of those who benefit directly from a product have spoken out in support of it. And if that's the case, then I think you have reasonable grounds to retain that cynicism or skepticism that you brought to the discussion in the first place. So those were the two points that he shared, and I echo them. I think that they apply to everything from supplements all the way to products like that that we've discussed today. And then finally, of course, you could listen to podcasts like this, where people do try to take down and explain the science with a healthy dose of sincerity and sometimes skepticism. So once again, a massive thanks to James for his time. Really do appreciate it and all the efforts that he's put into trying to explain this and other pseudoscience concepts. Hopefully we'll hear more like it in the future. Thank you for listening. As I said, we now embark on a journey of concussion discovery in amongst Vuelta coverage and a few other interesting side topics to boot. So we're really looking forward to having you join us for those and whatever else the world of sport and sports science throws up. Thank you once again for listening. Thank you once again for your support. And until next time, goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.